All right.
Well, Nathan, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself? So, beyond your message, which you sent to me, which I thought was very, very interesting.
Great. Well, I'm 37. I live in Ontario, and I live on a farm. Like, I have an organic farm that I run with my wife, but I'm also an animator. So I actually work from home as an animator, making cartoons for a living. And I work for a company in Toronto, but I live out 2.5 hours away in the rural part of Ontario. And so I sort of have these two things going on, farming and animating. So I spend a huge amount of my day on the computer drawing and making cartoons. And for whatever lucky reason, I'm able to do my work and also be listening to YouTube content. So I can absorb Peterson and you and all these other thinkers, which takes hours and hours and hours and hours of time.
Yeah.
So I remember you mentioning once that they're like the kinds of people who are into Peterson, you know, who are these kinds of people? Well, they're probably the kind of people who have a lifestyle that allows them to engage with large amounts of content, audio content.
Yeah.
So Thankfully I'm not one of those people who have a long commute.
Yes.
And I suspect they're another group of people who have this opportunity.
So tell me more how you got into the organic farming bit.
Interesting. I mean, I think this, you know, all these things will kind of run into our conversation, I expect. But for me, I would say, a big part of it was kind of like apocalyptic kind of thinking, you know, like being a young person in my early 20s, looking around at the world and kind of seeing societal breakdown, environmental breakdown, these kinds of things. I got quite nervous about it. And then I hooked into writers that were also nervous about it. And that just sort of fed a cycle of feeding that nervousness and rationalizing it further. And so that's how I initially found farming, is I was like, oh, I want to be self-sufficient. I want to be able to protect myself, you know, and sort of save myself against this apocalyptic vision of the future. And in so doing, then I met my wife, and then sort of transformed from just being this apocalyptic vision to being more like, oh, this is kind of a wonderful dream that we can create and follow. And it sort of lined up, you know, if I could go through and tick all the boxes of all the things that I thought would make a good life, to me, it seemed like if I could go down that checklist from what I understood at the time, I could tick off an incredible number of boxes. And so I thought, oh, well, this is a no-brainer. I pursued that path for quite a long time.
That's really interesting for me. I had a, for a while, I had a person in my church who was right out of college. She went to a Christian college, it's deep into Wendell Berry and very much wanted to, get into farming and for a while was running an organic farm, not too far from here. But now I think he's trying to do both. And I know a lot of farmers for whom, I mean, farming is their love, but they need a day job just to make, you know, farming practical. So it sounds like you've got an awesome combination of, you know, the animation and the farming. I can think of a lot of people I know that would listen to that and say, you are living their dream life.
Yeah.
My wife probably would think that, but.
Well, I also know that, like, there's tons of people who I know in Toronto who would say, like, you know, they're working in their offices and this is what they're dreaming about. But, and then I think this, you know, this takes a turn for me because, you know, 10 years into this project, I sort of discovered that what I used to believe or think was a good life wasn't actually fulfilling itself. So my kind of like preconceptions about what would lead to happiness, it's like, I sometimes say that I have a good life, but I don't know how to live a good life. So it's like, no matter, I have all this wonderful material circumstances, but happiness and peace and ease elude me. And that's what led me to sort of look into religion and to sort of turn away from materialistic pursuits, even though I think in some way I took I kind of see there's kind of two basic narratives in our materialistic culture, ways to go. One is to make a ton of money and pad your life that way. And one is to sort of give up material wealth and live a fulfilling life, right? So, you know, there's almost like you can be a lawyer or you can be an artist. And those are kind of the you know, those are the paths you follow. And I sort of picked the path of the artist, more or less, you know, like a farmer. You don't expect to make a lot of money. You expect that it's going to be fulfilling. It's intrinsically fulfilling, but it turns out for me, it's not intrinsically fulfilling. So I kind of, for me, I kind of feel like in some ways I reached the end of the road of the, of the stories of our culture, because I was raised in a really privileged background. So I never really wanted materially. So I sort of was able to experience what wealth and abundance could give you. And I've also experienced in some ways that other side of the story, which is to sort of give it up and pursue something for more altruistic reasons. And neither one of those stories ended with a happy ending.
Huh. Interesting. And you know, when listening to you, I think about, you know, again, as a pastor, you get to hear a lot of people's stories, which is one of the things I love about being a pastor. I've heard this story a lot, and, you know, we're talking about Buddhism a little bit, and, you know, obviously you think about, you know, you think about, I don't know a lot about Buddhism. I did read Karen Armstrong's biography of the Buddha and some other books. And, you know, it's kind of interesting listening to your story and thinking about the story of Siddhartha and, you know, his privileged lifestyle, and then his desire then for renunciation. And that theme is in, you know, that theme is currently running through a lot of Christian communities too, where people who, often people who, well, let me back up a little bit. When I look often at the, that's not even true. You look at, say, the prosperity gospel tribe. You look at, say, Joel Osteen's church. You know, huge numbers of what we would say today, people of color, and huge numbers from very distressed community looking for a prosperity gospel. Then I look at people who have grown up with a lot of affluence, many of them looking at more renunciation. And so what you just described is, I think, is also playing out within Christian communities too, and it's very interesting. So what, now when we talked in our message a little bit, you made a connection between kind of Buddhism as low-hanging fruit. And when you said that, that really connected with me, because I live in Northern California, and
so there's lots of fruit.
and many of my friends, so the I see in Northern California, the church community is quite distinct from the community. You know, we talked a little bit about public and private things, so I don't want to talk about my wife too much. Or my wife teaches in a Waldorf school, which is very much, which is very popular right now. It's a public Waldorf school, and big community of people who, you know, I saw Rupert Sheldrake say ABC, anything but Christian. I went to a party of a good friend of mine. It was a birthday party, and there was a woman there to do music for the party, and she was Native American. She played Native American music. She played Hindu music. And it was very interesting, because before she wanted to play a kind of a 60s Christian folk spiritual song, but she gave no disclaimers before she played anything from any of the other religious traditions that she was using. But before she said the Christian one, she had to give this long disclaimer. And I completely understood it in the context of the party, because most of the people at that party I knew had grown up Roman Catholic, Protestant of some sort, and they had all walked away from this. And most of the people at the party were into some kind of spirituality, they would say. And so this is, you know, in my realm here outside of the church, so I live in these multiple worlds. So in big friends community with a lot of people who are, you know, they're actually practitioners of different spiritualities. And so when you mentioned Buddhism as a low-hanging fruit, I also have another friend who they don't live here in California. They live across the country. I met them when we lived overseas. And the wife is about the most devout Sam Harris atheist good friend that I have, and he comes out once a year or so because he has a Zen Buddhist master that lives in the foothills here, and so he makes his pilgrimage once a year, and he goes up there, and he actually does ornamental fish farming in Florida. And so it's been very interesting for me. Whenever he comes up, he always has a day at the beginning of the or the end or so where I can kind of debrief him and say, you know, what did you learn this time? And how is this for you? And his brother is a Southern red state fundamentalist Christian. And so, you know, it's an interesting time in our culture because we have all of these things living side by side, often within families. And so when you just that short snippet of your story, I thought, wow, you are kind of a poster child for some element of this, and then the connection with Jordan Peterson. So now you mentioned already that you, and I totally get that, you have to fill your brain with something during certain kinds of work, and you can only listen to so much music. So like in my meetup, there's a lot of people who are in your line of work. They do some kind of work with technology. And so one person in my meetup, he says, you know, for years, all he does is listen to university lecturers. And that's where he found Jordan Peterson, because Peterson was posting his stuff. So when did you find Peterson, and what has that been like for you?
I'll answer your question in a sec, but my son just got home. So I'm just going to go close the door and tell him that to try and be quiet.
No problem. Okay.
So, I think I started finding out about him like January or February of 2016, or like whenever he was very, very, very first in the news. I can't remember exactly how I came across him, but I think one thing that was really, there was sort of a confluence of two things that happened when I encountered him is, you know, as I've been pursuing meditation and Buddhism, part of the process is it's kind of like undermining what it is that you think that you know. It's challenging profound assumptions about your meaning-making machine. And so I started to become really keyed into the idea of giving things a chance and leaning hard into not knowing, you know, rather than going around with an attitude of knowing, going around more with an attitude of not knowing. And he sort of came up at the same time that I was experiencing that. And so I thought, oh, this is a really excellent place for me to engage because it helps me further this kind of practice that I want to pursue. And at the same time, he was also reinforcing that same message. So he was challenging me from my what I now think of as my default views. Before then, I just think I had a set of default opinions. I didn't really think about them or develop them myself. And since then, now, you know, at least I've done some work to excavate what those beliefs are based on and tried to sort of sort out if I actually think that or not. But listening to him, and then all the people that kind of, you know, in some way he's like a star or something. And there's all these people orbiting him on YouTube, right? They all link to all these different thinkers, and it's just kind of this ecosystem of thought. Yep. And, you know, I'm also connected into all that. And, you know, in general, the idea of sort of challenging your assumptions and sort of these philosophical questions about what is true and how do you discern what is true? What's the ground that you stand on to base your ideas and things like that? That my practices and my investigations in Buddhism just perfectly flow into that conversation, and so they kind of are mutually reinforcing. Mm-hmm.
And so how? Let me think about this. So how did? I mean, so Peterson kind of comes at thing. I mean, Peterson's kind of been known for bread pilling people, you know. And what I mean by bread pilling is, people get interested in Christianity, and that's kind of where this whole thing found me. I got interested in Peterson because he was giving these Bible lectures, and I thought, well, this is interesting. And then I saw how popular his Bible lectures are, and I thought, wow, there's a lot more people listening to him talk about the Bible than me. What does that say about me? And so then, you know, very quickly, and actually in many ways, the, you know, if someone would be crazy enough to watch my YouTubes from beginning until now, I've pretty much documented a lot of my evolution with respect to him. Mm-hmm. to figure out, okay, why does he esteem the Bible? Because he comes at it from a very different place than, let's say, I was brought up in from a Christian tradition. And from a Christian tradition, it's coming in from on top, from God. He's coming down from below through evolution and Darwin, and saying that, you know, through Jung, saying that this, you know, this is how we piece together the world. I have to give a disclaimer, because people regularly ask me about Buddhism. And so the disclaimer I give is this. Number one, I've read some things on it, but being a Christian and listening to non-Christians talk about Christianity, I have to own a serious amount of, I really don't know what I'm talking about. Because if you're outside of it, you're outside of it. So that's one angle. And the other angle is that even the little I know about Buddhism is older than Christianity. I don't know that it's older than Judaism, but it's older than Christianity, and it's incredibly broad, because as with other religions, there's always the cultural matrix and then the religious piece. And in every culture, they sort of, you know, come together in a unique way. And so my experience with people who come to Buddhism out of secularism is that for many people, it is a fairly easy religious tradition to begin to appropriate, because unlike Christianity, where in a sense, so secularity grew out of Christianity, so secularity already has some built-in answers and defenses against Christianity. I don't know a lot, but what I know of some Hindu ontologies and conceptions of presuppositions about the universe out of which Buddhism grew up out of, that's a very different thing. And so in some of my friends who have really gone into Buddhism, and really I see two groups there in my experience. One group are people who get a lot of Buddhist statues because they hear a Buddhist thing now and then, and they say, wow, I'm really into that. And I think, all right, but you're just as acquisitive, and you know, you don't denounce anything. And so I always wonder that, you know, if you look at kind of the root of Buddhism, the four and the eight, it's like, do you know any of those things? Because you're not renouncing anything. And I see other friends who are, and some of these people might do a little bit of meditation, but they're doing a little bit of meditation to kind of make their life better. You know, some of my other friends who go into it deeply, who, let's say, will in fact, you know, like my friend who flies out every year or so. I mean, when he describes what he does at his Buddhist retreat, I think, that's serious. I mean, you are sitting there and you are working your meditation, and you're up in the California foothills, and yeah, it's beautiful, but it's also cold in the winter, and you know, you're sleeping in a tent and you're eating minimally. And so someone like that who is truly pursuing, asceticism. Well, okay. Then I say, okay, well now I'm going to take you a lot more seriously, because what little I understand from Buddhism, if you truly believe that the root of your suffering are your attachments, that's a very simplified version, then naturally you want to address those attachments, and if you truly believe that the world is a very different place from what we assume it to be via what we get from our senses, this manifest image, and I talked about that quite a bit in the Hoffman video a couple of days ago, it's going to take a lot of work to unlearn those things. And that's kind of what I just heard you describing.
Yes.
So how deep have you gotten into this?
Well, I mean, I think in a similar way, I'll make a disclaimer in that I am still young in my Buddhist career. Like, I've only been doing it for about 4 years, well, 5 years, but 4 years where I sort of decided to get serious about it. Like,
okay.
I sought out a teacher, like I have a relationship with him. I talk on a regular basis. Like I help in the community. I study on a regular basis, and you know, I'm like kind of transforming my life via the technology of the Dharma. And so, I mean, while I'm new at it, I am quite full into it.
Okay.
I would say.
Well, that's helpful. And, that's helpful.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Now, again, especially if you listen to a guy like Hoffman, who I talked a couple of days ago. I don't know if you've seen that video.
I watched that, yeah.
Okay. You know, you can see, listening to what he's saying, you begin with consciousness and then you move towards materiality. And you could see that a lot of, you know, a Hindu community picked up on him and had him. You can see why a lot of those groups would kind of migrate towards that, because there is an alignment between what he's teaching and some of what these other ancient traditions have taught. And so that I think is interesting. So I guess my question is, now Peterson, you know, he's been known to bread pill people, but he stays cagely sort of on the outside. And that's a huge debate that I don't care to get into right now. But this practice of, okay, doubting what is conventional wisdom and going deeper. So how do you see Peterson as connecting into your journey?
I think that, like, from a cultural perspective, that he's really tearing down cultural idols. And so, you know, in the journey of trying to, I mean, I don't know if, like, I'm not a trained philosopher. I would say I'm like a philosopher by inclination, not by training. So I may get some of my terms not quite right. But one of the ways I think of Buddhism is it's kind of like, it's like a epistemological gym. Like, it's really making you really clear and strong and grounded in your epistemology. And I mean that like in an embodied way, like you're seeing, you're hearing, you're thinking, you're smelling. Like, to me, all philosophical things are derived from these senses. You know, in Buddhism, they call them the sense doors. And in Buddhism, thinking is considered your sixth sense. It's not like some kind of strange, you know, quasi-supernatural sort of thing. It's like, no, it's just as ordinary as seeing or smelling or whatever. And, you know, Peterson is getting at a lot of the thinking stuff. So he's tearing down, you know, like, I can't help, I've noticed in my own introspection that when we talk about, you know, Peterson talks about belief, you know, you don't necessarily believe what you say, you know, you believe what you do. Right. And when I examine my own behaviors and my own patterns of thinking, I mean, I have to say that I am deeply Christian, because I recognize the stories and the narratives that I'm acting out in the world are Christian stories. So one way that so Peterson's helped me, in some ways, he's bread pilled me in the sense that he's helped to elevate and clear away the dirt that's been thrown at the tradition, the Christian tradition, and clear it away and kind of show, like, oh, there's value here. Stop ignoring it. And so I have a mental habit, let's say a culturally indoctrinated habit of ignoring it and kind of, treating it, like, as he says, like a smart 13-year-old atheist, you know, like treating it in that way.
Yeah.
But then he's helped me see, like, oh, well, no, like, I am a North American. I was raised in Canada. Like, even though I grew up in a kind of a religious household, we were neither Christian nor not Christian, nor religion was just not even a part of our lives at all, neither for nor against. And, even in that setting, you know, he's helped me understand that the Christian stories are foundational. They're through everything in our culture, and I recognize them in myself. So that's how I can confirm that for myself, is that, oh, okay, well, like I'll take a story that I've been very committed to over time, which is something like the world needs fixing. There's things that are broken in the world and I need to do something about it. I've sort of come to recognize that, like, actually that's a Christian story. And this ties back to Buddhism because, and it's something that I actually quoted you on Facebook saying yesterday, but it was like, you know, until you have a religion, you can't get the distance required to realize all the other kind of quasi-religious beliefs that you already have. It's kind of like, it's the same thing in mindfulness. It's like, if you're not being mindful and you're, say, angry, you don't know that you're angry. You're just acting out of anger. You're embodying anger, but mindfulness gives you the opportunity to sort of separate yourself. And you're just like, oh, here am I, and here's my anger. Now I can actually make a choice. This is where freedom exists. Is there's actually freedom to choose. And so by committing myself to Buddhism, and I think to use that word is important to say I'm committed to it, in that, like, I've made a decision, and I'm going to follow that road as long as I can. That also gives me the freedom to value Christianity and to see it as this incredibly worthwhile part of me. And I think it was hard for me to see that before, when I only came at it from this sort of atheistic, rejecting kind of perspective, because I don't know. It's like it was like a kid who has no appreciation for their parents, in a way, you know, just always angry, is never enough. And like, all, you know, that was the kind of emotional and intellectual stuff I was playing out, even though I wasn't necessarily aware of it.
I think that's a baseline position. And I think, you know, especially in some of the, in the Dillahunty conversation, where Peterson, you know, leans, well, it's certainly where in my commentary of it, where we're unaware of how deeply rooted the default package we receive from our culture is tied with Christianity. If you're growing up in the West, that is just so foundational, which is why when I, you know, in a number of videos I've commented that when I look at the current culture war that's going on in, say, Canada and the United States, I see this as a Christendom civil war, because you know, and this bothers a lot of my friends on the right. I'll say, you know, you're really not going to get to a point of embracing gay marriage without Christianity. And even if you believe that gay marriage is against the tenets of Christianity, the impulse to, you know, hospitably embrace and reframe things sufficient to get to the point of saying, you know, our society should legalize gay marriage, that itself comes so deeply out of the ethos of Christ. Now, Christians to the left of me will say, oh, absolutely. But Christians to the right of me will say, no way. But to see that both the left and the right are working out elements that are deep within Christianity in differing and conflicting ways, to me, that's obvious. And if you look back throughout church history, this has happened again and again and again. The Donatist controversy, for example, in the 5th century that Augustine was born into, where Roman persecution would happen, and one side would say priests who renounced the faith ought not to be let back into the fold. Well, there's something, you know, there's something very Christian and natural about that. And then the Catholic position, which was priests that had denounced the faith under persecution may be let back into the priesthood. And that's so Augustine's mother sided with the Donatists, and Augustine eventually sided with the Catholic faith. And but both of those ideas, you can trace both of them into Christianity and in other things. And so I think the realization you came to is a big part of, I think, the massive bread pilling we see Peterson doing, in that he's kind of decluttering a lot of the adolescent reactivity to the parent, the judgmental father, and saying, yeah, but you know what? When you get to a certain age, you kind of know where your dad was coming from, because you know, all that drug doing and sleeping around, what really did that get you?
So, well, go on.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it wasn't until I was experiencing a lot of sort of depression and like difficulties in my life that I then came to say, okay, well, this isn't working anymore. And I wonder what other atheists and materialists do when they encounter difficulties like that. I can't speak for them, but what it seems like to me a lot of people do is we use the modern technologies, which are obviously so powerful, you know, whether it's psychology or whether it's drugs, like pharmaceutical drugs, antidepressants, or whether it's even simple, like more common things like Netflix or something. We are so good at constantly putting off the kind of reckoning with our lives. That's kind of how it seems like to me. And I don't know if I'm fortunate that I felt that reckoning acutely or something. Like, who knows why I went down this road, but in some ways I think it's because I engaged in a religion, and in some ways it helps me understand also not just Peterson, but by engaging in a religion, whether it's, I think it would be the same whether it was Christianity or Buddhism, but by sincerely engaging in it, then a lot of that other stuff kind of falls away and you can see the emptiness of it. And it kind of reminds me a little bit about what this drama that's been going on, you know, between someone like Peterson and someone like Dillahunty, where, like you say, they're sort of talking past each other. And it's this frustrating situation where, like, you don't know until you know. You know, Dillahunty or someone, you can kind of use language to try and explain it, but at some level, it's not, you're not communicating at the level of language. Like, we're communicating at the level of our lives, right? At the level of our kind of embodiment. And I think another way that Peterson's really helped me out is to give me this new language of kind of pragmatism and talking about embodied truth and just shoring that up to compete with the kind of language of things and the language of measuring, and as if there's just things and I'm just a thing. And, you know, there's this famous quotation that I really love from a Buddhist scholar named Shantideva. And it goes something like, I don't want to mangle it. Maybe I should look it up. But basically, you know, should I cover the world over in leather to protect myself from thorns and prickles? Or should I just cut a pair of sandals out of that leather and wear them? And in a similar way, you know, instead of trying to change the whole world, I need to take responsibility for my mind. Like, I need to take responsibility for my life. And then that's the fruitful way to engage. Whereas, you know, I sort of perceive maybe the atheist types, they're kind of in the mode of covering over the world in leather to protect themselves. And so they're engaging with psychotherapy, or, you know, which can be beneficial, obviously, but how deeply are you encountering yourself? I don't know. It's so hard to tell. Who can say how honest someone's being with themselves? Only they can. Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know that any of us can. You know, I think of, so I sent you the Peter Kreeft, The Dark Side.
Yeah, I listened to it.
And it's, you know, one of the things that Kreeft makes the point, Kreeft was, in all, Kreeft grew up in northern New Jersey like I did. He went to Eastern Christian like I did. And he went to Calvin College like I did. And then he joined the Roman Catholic Church. You know, really ticked off all the Dutch Calvinists. But Kreeft has taught at Boston College and is known as a Roman Catholic apologist. He makes the distinction that in the ancient world, you know, probably due, he doesn't say this, but probably due to the lack of technology, the basic goal of a human being was to try to conform yourself to the way the world was and adapt yourself, because you couldn't change the world. Mm. I think after I think our contemporary challenge is opposite. We
have, what time period did you refer to there when people had to change themselves?
The ancient world. So you're talking, you know, you're talking the ancient East, you're talking the ancient West. Basically, you know, life was brutal and hard. There wasn't medicine. There wasn't modern amusements. You, maybe you could do some peyote and have a trip or, but, you know, Bessel, this is the guy who wrote about trauma, the body keeps the score. You know, he basically talks about, you know, Europe got through the Middle Ages on alcohol. You know, that's basically says that's how they managed. And so in contemporary world, we've gotten so good at dominating and I'd say colonizing nature that we now come with the default position of I am going to control the world to suit it to my inner taste. And so, for example, when we see the gender controversies about I do not need to be defined by the biological sex I was born with. I mean, this is a kind of a quintessential expression of the contemporary mindset where we believe we have the power to take life and, you know, bring it to heal to our will. And so this long battle between nature and humanity, we've gained the upper hand, but now suddenly we discover, oh man, we need nature and we're part of nature. And that's where kind of you get into the Genesis 2 anthropology, where Adam is the stuff of earth and the breath of God. And so Adam can't deny his earthly nature because that's what he's made of. But then he, in a sense, tries in Genesis 3, he revolts to say, okay, God, we're going to take the stuff. In a sense, he says what the prodigal son says in Luke 15. We want the stuff, but we don't want you. Let us manage it on our own. And so, and it sounds like many others, you came to the point of saying, I kind of like to try the ancient way. Because, and you kind of haven't, you've kind of embodied that even with your organic farming, because that in a sense is a move back to say, which is very common in our society right now, it's the natural, but we've got a great antipathy with the natural because as Peterson says often, infections are natural, viruses are natural. And so we've got this mm-hmm. weird relationship with it.
Well, we want the world the way we want it. And when we don't get it the way we want it, then we get pissed off. And I can't remember the quote now. I don't know if this is correct. Again, I've been listening to you and to Peterson and other people, so I have sort of some Christian ideas and thoughts in my head, so I don't know if they're accurate or not. But, you know, it's like, in some ways, wisdom, I don't know if this is correct, but to say that like wisdom starts with the fear of God, to recognize that that whatever you try, like it's going to work until it doesn't work anymore. That, you know, all of your striving, all of your sort of worldly attempts to push back what seems to be a quintessential problem in life are doomed to fail. You know, even if you're lucky enough to make it up to your deathbed, let's say you put things up long enough, it's going to catch up to you in some way. And I mean, in some ways, hopefully it catches up to you sooner rather than later so that you can take responsibility for your life and then start to, you know, I also really love this Christian, this word, the idea of being reborn. I guess it's a Buddhist idea too, isn't it? But, you know, born again Christian is a term that I've heard a lot. And it seems like to me in some ways that like I am being born again, this time like as an adult, that up until I started actually taking responsibility for my life and my mind and doing these practices that really, really make life intimate, that I was just a teenager kind of playing out, you know, the cultural stories that I was given and sort of playing out my own personal history and stuff. And that would have been great if it just could kept going. But fortunately or unfortunately for me, it kind of broke down, you know, a few years ago.
I used to, for a while, I was listening to a podcast by Mark Maron, who is a
comedian.
He's a comedian and he interviews lots and lots of people. And unfortunately, I've never been able to find this podcast again. But I remember he was talking about the fact that, you know, because recovery is a big thing with him. And this is, you know, natural. So suddenly we have all this power. We have all this affluence. The world is my oyster. Well, what do we do? Well, our appetites, you know, this gets very much into Buddhism. Our appetites run wild. Well, okay, so we let our appetites run wild. Where does that take us? You know, think about Russell Brand. Well, it leads us to destroy ourselves. This great quote from Terminator 2, humanity is destroying itself. And so Marin, his comment was, you know, yeah, a lot of people get sober, but it's the really hardcore addicts that have to turn to Christianity because it's kind of like nothing else will keep them. And they become what many in the more secular community look at as the far lunatic Christians. I mean, they become the Pentecostals who hear God talking to them and, you know, God is helping them find parking spaces and so on and so forth. So, but it was just interesting when Mark Maron made that observation, I thought, yeah, because they discovered they needed the Heidelberg Catechism, which is one of the doctrinal statements of my tradition. The first question and answer is, what is your only comfort in life and in death? And the beginning of the answer is the most un-American thing you could imagine, that I am not my own, but belong body and soul and life and in death to my faithful Savior, Jesus Christ. It's a renunciation of personal ownership, which someone might say, well, is that slavery? Kind of, but what does it mean when you voluntarily deliver yourself into the hands of another? And that brings so much dissonance within our culture. And, and again, Christianity, because it's not an ideology, it's a fully fledged religion, Christianity will also say, yeah, that's also perfect freedom. And you would say, we taste some of those paradoxes, for example, in a marriage. If it's only when you get to the point of actually surrendering yourself to this other person that you become free. And it's the difference between living together where you're saying to this other person, yeah, I'm going to live with you and have sex with you and share my life with you until something better comes along. And a marriage where you say, I'm going to live my life to you with you and I'm going to devote myself to you. Even if something better comes along, I'm going to say no to it. Mm-hmm. And that then affords a degree of freedom where you can go to the bathroom with the door open and, you know, all the horrible things that marriage just is. And
you can have a body. Yeah,
that's right. You can have a body and your spouse will see you at your worst. They will know what an asshole you really are and they will stay with you and you will stay with them. I mean, it's that then being deep freedom. So, you know,
and I think, yeah, that makes me, I mean, I guess we should make sure we talk about what we messaged about, which is the connecting the atheism to Buddhism. But one thing that I thought of when you were talking is, hopefully I don't lose it here. That's a kind of a core tenet of Buddhism is that there's no self, that, you know, when you look very, very closely at your experience, you'll see that, you know, this person that you call you, like, where is this person to be found? You know, you go looking for the self, you don't find one. And yet there also is the self. So Buddhism is, I think it's a good, it makes sense out of nonsense, or makes nonsense out of sense in that, like you say, you know, there is a self, of course, because who's going to go pee for you, right? Like, who's going to take your kid to daycare? But then there also is no self because, you know, I didn't decide to enjoy strawberry shortcake. You know, I just do. Where did that preference come from? I don't know. I didn't choose to like it. I just do like it. So Buddhism, I like, you know, it's kind of maybe in some ways it's in the idea of like the Holy Trinity. It's like it doesn't make sense, you know, from our very limited materialistic perspective of sense making. But you know, when you engage in that sort of nonsense, you find a much deeper reality, a deeper truth that then does give you that freedom, that distance from the tyranny of the self. yeah, that again, like you can find it in many ways, you know, whether it's your marriage or whether it's through Christianity, giving yourself to Jesus, or Buddhism, you know, if you recognize what's going on and you can own up to it, then yeah, there's like liberation, freedom from that, and choice. Whereas before, like the kind of choices that it seems like you're making, they're choices, but it's like when you go into an iPhone store and there's a choice of covers for your iPhone, like, yeah, I have a choice of 50 things, but is that choice? Like, is that freedom of choice really? Like, there's five kinds of Doritos. Oh, great. I can choose what kind of Doritos I want, but like, what kind of choice is that? It's pretty shallow. Yeah. So it's interesting. Like I'm listening to that Dr. Kreef lecture, and I just keep hearing Buddhism and everything he's saying. It's, you know, maybe I haven't spent long enough to know where these distinctions lie. Obviously there's profound distinctions in the different doctrines, but I think, I mean, obviously if a religion lasts as long as Buddhism or Christianity, it's not just because of power, right? It's not just because some group is dominating another group. It's because it actually works for human beings in their lives and makes a difference and makes life more than just livable. Yeah.
If there was nothing to any of this, it would have long disappeared.
Yeah.
I think, you know, part of what, you know, when you look at Christianity and Buddhism, I mean, obviously dominant to Christianity is a large narrative structure with respect to God, with respect to heaven and earth, with respect to the world. And I think for that reason, you know, as I said before, secularism has grown out of Christianity. And for that reason, that narrative is hard for people to swallow. And so, for example, I'm still not done processing Peterson's Easter thing. And I'm once I get kind of finish up with the Dillahunty stuff, which just seems to keep going, I'm going to go back to Peterson's Easter thing, because, you know, what I often find people really struggle with is this idea of Jesus' historical resurrection coming that his body actually came out of the tomb, and obviously built into the stories is he's still got the wounds on his hands, and you think, okay, but he's also hard to recognize, and so you try to figure out, well, what does this mean? And there's a strong desire to keep this as a metaphor and a story, but foundational to Christianity has always been this idea that resurrection is not just a story that gives us life within this frame of reference, but is testimony to us as individuals surviving what we all know as death. And that idea itself seriously impacts how we live our life now. You know, for example, if you were part of the Confederacy in the American Civil War, if you knew the Confederacy would lose, which would not be a hard thing to know, you could pretty quickly not want to use Confederate currency, because, you know, suddenly the black market in Union currency would probably be high, because everybody in the recesses of their minds are always doing these cost benefit analysis to say, you know, I want to do this and I want my best life now. That's kind of the default biological position we have. And so then Christianity says to people, okay, but what you're living in right now is just the front porch of a far greater life. And say, as opposed to ideas that I understand, let's say coming out of Hinduism, where your individuality and your connection to this narrative story you call yourself will be finally severed or dismissed entirely. Christianity, the idea is that all of what has happened to Paul Vanderclay in history will be folded into the perfected Paul Vanderclay that God raises from the dead, and that that story continues. And when I think about, let's say, something as applicable as marriage, it then becomes a leverage. For example, I can look at my wife and say, yeah, you know, I picked you when I was in my 20s. What did I know? And even who was I? Now I'm in my 50s. I want a wife that suits me now. And so nuts to you, because, you know, we have this YOLO, you only live once. You know, I need to get out of life everything I can. And part of what the Christian, part of what a very crunchy historical literal idea of resurrection says is that I can be married to, now my wife doesn't have Alzheimer's, but I can be married to someone with Alzheimer's and maybe spend the next 10 or 15 years living out a vow that I made when I was mindlessly in my 20s because she looked hot and I thought I knew what the world was. And I can spend the rest of my life devoted to her because this is just a bit of what I will finally be. And so in that sense, I find a historical resurrection being a tremendous help for Christians living out this cruciform lifestyle. And this then was manifest, for example, in the Roman Empire. When the plague hit the town, people in their right minds fled. Christians stayed and cared for plague victims at the cost of their life. Why? Because they believed that what they were spending in this world was Confederate money. And so, and so for me, that's part of how, you know, where I see Christianity's attraction. And then, you know, people will come back at me and say, yeah, but what if you're wrong? Because that's the thing. I bank on this resurrection, and I do all these things that if you only live once are really dumb. And I say, well, you know, if I'm wrong, I will have spent my life sacrificially blessing other people. I don't know that that's a worse way to live than covered with the dust of Cheetos in front of computer games, which is probably how I'd spend it anyway. So, Anyway, there's my little Christian appeal. Maybe that was part of you wanted to go into.
No, it's great. It's nice.
So what kind of questions did you have?
Oh, I can't remember. I guess, you know, in some ways we're getting into it. Like in this endeavor to be, you know, truly skeptical and to sort of like, you know, not knowing and sort of coming to things, in a spirit of, I don't know, then, I kind of wanted to hear or have a conversation about, Buddhism and Christianity and, maybe where they differ and where they are similar, but also, you know, maybe we could start that. We've already begun it, but tying in this idea of the atheist and why Buddhism seems to be a low-hanging fruit, because this ties into one of the things I want to talk about. For me, and who knows if this is similar to others, but I can't help but extrapolate my experience onto others. One of the reasons I really loved or was attracted to Buddhism was, I mean, I was superficially attracted to the idea that, like, oh, well, there's no God, right? I don't have to believe in a God, because at that time that was too difficult for me in that stage. But the other thing that really got me, the thing that like really attracted me, was the idea of meditation, that like there's this daily thing that I do. It's very tangible. And I just do it. Like in that way, it's kind of materialistic. Like I just have to sit and I do this practice and I engage with it. And it's just, it's very cut and dry in a way. It's like you sit down however you're comfortable and you spend your time trying to keep your awareness on the sensations of breathing, let's say. And I could understand that. So it's like the barrier for entry was so low that I just had to be willing to do that thing. And the other thing that goes along with that is that to me, it seems that Buddhism is very empirical in that it's all based on evidence, even though the evidence is introspective evidence, you know, and maybe some people don't think that that has rigor, but I kind of reflect on, well, how many anecdotes does it take to become a fact? You know, we call them anecdotes, but when we collect enough anecdotes together, then people can put it in a journal. So, you know, I think there's validity there. So, you know, so Buddhism in some ways is low hanging because it's got this factor like, okay, there's no God. That's kind of, it's got the window dressing that people are looking for. So, they can approach the store, right? They're not put off by the signage. And then when they get into the store, they're given a very clear thing like, oh, just sit down and do this and you'll discover for yourself. And
no God is you know, that's not an obstacle because there's no God. It's very empirical. This is something you can do. This is in a sense something that, yeah, this is go ahead. I thought that
it ties into all the kind of preferences that the atheist culture has. So it's got all, it meets all their preferences. So there's no barriers for them. And then, you know, one thing I've noticed is that, like for Sam Harris, and I don't know about Robert Wright, but he's written a book called Why Buddhism is True. And he was the one who interviewed Hoffman.
Okay.
He is a Buddhist practitioner.
Okay.
Yeah. And some others who do this, you know, what I've noticed is they kind of stick to the older style of Buddhism, what's called Theravada. That's sort of what's called Vipassana or the insight meditation style. That's like Richard or Goldstein and the other sort of prominent American mindfulness people. And that's sort of the most stripped down in some ways version of Buddhism. And, you know, there's other developments in the history of Buddhism, like Mahayana, which comes later in the history, and it has a more sort of religious flavor to it. Even though it still has the core tenets and the core doctrines, there's Theravada Buddhism can tie more in with the kind of modern Western atheism, because while there is ethics and there's a strong ethical practice to follow, they don't have the same narratives that the Mahayana does. It has less narratives. And I think the Mahayana, like, there's this concept in Mahayana Buddhism called the Bodhisattva. And that's somebody who attains clarity and they see into the nature of reality, but they stay in the world. They kind of, you know, to follow the narrative of rebirth, they don't choose to leave the cycle of rebirth. They choose to come back to alleviate the suffering of all beings. So they're constantly being reborn as someone to help others achieve clarity or enlightenment. And I don't see those atheist thinkers ever engaging with that part of Buddhism. They're only engaging with this other side of things, which is quite stripped down. And in some ways, you can kind of just keep your life as it is without, that's kind of my sense. I could be wrong, but you can kind of keep your life in some ways, even though you can engage deeply into this inquiry, you can kind of hold it at arm's length at all times. Like, you can kind of engage in this way in a kind of philosophical way that's kind of dry and almost like a computer program. Rather than entering into a tradition, let's say. And one of the things I found helpful for myself, and maybe why I'm making this distinction, is I sort of agree with Peterson, I think, just to say that, you know, you can't live without a story. You can't live without some kind of structure. And it seems like the best I can do at this moment is to be aware enough to actually be choosing my story rather than just having my story chosen for me, which is basically what my life was before that. And so for me, it's all about choosing this story of the Bodhisattva story. You know, that's the narrative that I'm going to live by, because it seems, in a similar way to the story you're telling about a Christian, you know, why would these Christians stay in the town that's full of disease and plague? Well, it's because they're more than just themselves, right? They're more, there's more to life than this life. There's you know, whether rebirth is a metaphor or not, it's kind of irrelevant. It's the same logic that leads you to the position, oh yeah, I'm going to stay in the town because that's what I'm doing. That's the game I'm playing. And you know, if I'm going to pick between games, this seems like the best game in town after, you know, investigating. So kind of veered off a bit, but I think that's how I think about maybe some of the reasons why the Buddhism, especially this Theravada style, is an easy sell to the atheists. And Stoicism is probably even easier.
Yeah. Well, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. It seems very natural. And I this is reflected in my own thinking, you know, as our cultural norms continue to break down. I think Jonathan Pageau calls it, or some other people call it, the meaning crisis, and this crisis of meaning. Like, where's the ground? Like, where's the center that I can make sense of the terrifying flux of reality from? And it seems, for me anyways, that like doing meditation, you know, it seems insanely simple, but like when you're sitting, like the Buddha taught, you know, sit down and say to yourself, when I breathe in, I know I'm breathing in. When I breathe out, I know I'm breathing out. Huh. And you kind of start there. You're like, okay, I can know this. I can know that at least. And you can kind of, and then you're able to build your epistemology over time as you become more and more confident in your own truth detection system. Which I think, you know, again, like Peterson's talking about free speech as a sort of truth detecting mechanism, and that none of us know what the truth is. And so we all come together as a collection of idiots, and somehow out of that collection of idiots, we find the appropriate path to delve given the circumstances of the moment. And it seems to me that, you know, I could be a more useful idiot than I am if I had sort of enacted the principles of free speech in my own mind, like in my own embodied presence. You know, then I can come to the table a bit more clear-headed. Yeah.
It's kind of I breathe, therefore I am, kind of a strange Cartesian
right.
construction project. That's uh-huh. interesting. And your description of the two Buddhisms was really helpful to me, because, you know, you look at, for example, well, I live in California. Well, Montreal is a terribly diverse place too. So I know Chinese Buddhists and Japanese Buddhists and Korean Buddhists. But their Buddhism doesn't look like, let's say, Richard Gere, who, you know, and then I listen, you look at the, you know, you look at the Dalai Lama, who, you know, people probably, in my neck of the woods, probably more respect for the Dalai Lama. They'll turn out to see him before they turn out to see the Pope. Well, there's a lot of Hispanics and Latin Americans around here too, so it might be a tough competition. But what's interesting to me too is kind of that description of the stripped down Buddhism reminds me in some ways of the difference, let's say, between the Orthodox and the Catholics and the Protestants, because one of the real differences between Protestantism and, let's say, the Orthodox and the Catholic traditions are that those, as older traditions, tend to be two-speed religions, which mean that there's kind of a religion for the common folks, and then there's the spiritual athletes, and the monastic traditions are there for the athletes. And I will support the monastics, and they'll pray for me, and so via my financial support of them, I gain benefits, I gain merits, you know, on their behalf. And so you find that in the Roman Catholic tradition and Orthodoxy. Protestantism, really the path was everyone can be a spiritual athlete. But in adjusting that speed, what you tend to do is you take the religious values that were usually seen as, you know, Roman Catholics have nature and grace, again, kind of a two-speed, two-level thing. You try to put them all into one. So, for example, Calvin in Geneva wants it to become a holy city. And what that means is that you have something like the priesthood of all believers, where you're not going to be a monk setting aside your entire life for meditation in a Buddhist tradition or prayer in a Christian tradition. But as a Christian, I am going to be, in a Calvinist tradition, I am going to be a Christian farmer, or a Christian scholar, or a Christian business person, and that it's in the context of my business life that my Christianity comes to flourishing. And of course, that then gets very much wedded and big discussion about to what degree is that then related to the Enlightenment, where you know, Calvinists come into the fray and in a sense say, you know, my this one speed religion is where I find everything. And I don't know, that might be kind of analogous to this stripped down Buddhism that
yeah.
keeps it here. Although in another hand, go ahead.
Yeah, well, in the Theravadan tradition, there is definitely that. There is that sort of spiritual athleticism idea, and also, I shouldn't talk about things I don't know too much about, but that's definitely present there. Yeah, so that sounds familiar. And the Mahayana has a more egalitarian, if I could use that word, kind of aspect to it.
Okay. And so for, you know, I've talked a fair amount about my Calvinism, and that draws a lot of comments from people because Calvinism is pretty diverse, but my brand of it, you know, basically in some sense, I deal with how little I can know by, in a sense, leaving that to God. And so you have a kind of a client server metaphor you could use. Calvinists leave a lot on the server and keep a pretty thin client. And what that means is that I may be totally wrong about a whole bunch of things, but when, for example, the first question and answer of the Heidelberg Catechism, you know, what is my only comfort? My only comfort is that I don't even belong to me. Well, what does that mean? It means that, you know, I am going to, in a sense, rely on the server for, you know, what comes into my life, that maybe you have an unfortunate illness, or maybe you have a low IQ, or maybe you have the wrong gender or race in a particular context where your group is out of favor, or maybe you were born a slave, or all the kind of unfortunate things that can happen to you. All of those things might be true, but I have a belief that my best life now does not depend on my capacity to know enough to get this right. And that then leaves a fair amount of freedom to say, boy, I have to liberate myself from, well, I don't. And I believe that Calvinists are known for a fairly strong doctrine of a fairly strong sense of providence, that even the bad things that come into my life, God will use those for my good and the world's good. And there is a strong capacity for renunciation in that by saying, and it's very un-American, by saying, you know, I don't need to take back America or, you know, grab your soul to save you. You know, I can't even save myself. How am I going to save you? So when I talk about Calvinism, people often wonder, because there's a lot of different kinds of Calvinists, and that's, but in terms of this conversation, that's kind of where it goes for me, that I'm only able to really get one speed, and I don't do it very well, but my final rest does not come in my capacity to employ a religion or gain power or status. So.
Oops, sorry. The farm is calling me. Yeah, well, we should probably wrap it up anyways, because we have lambs being born, and I'm
probably
being called to help.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for this. I'll pause this right. I'll.
I feel like I want to apologize to all the people who know more than me who I pissed off, and I hope that I hope that it spurns you to have conversations and explain how I got things wrong. So hopefully, anyone who's pissed off that I got things wrong, I invite you to please bug Paul and have a conversation and clarify things, or write in the
comments. Put it in the comments section.
Yeah.
Fix it in the comments. Well, I do that all the time. I get all kinds of things wrong. Yeah. Everyone should have a comment section. Would you like me to post this, or shall I just erase this? It's up to you.
Well, if you think it's valuable, then that would be great.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'll keep it then, because I thought it was valuable, and part of the reason why it's nice to post is that I can, you know, maybe 1,000 people will watch it, but who cares? Again, the comment section is well worth it, because if you don't invest it in your ego too much, you can learn a ton in the comments. So
Yeah. Well, I'll find out exactly how much I have invested already if I see them.
That's true. Well, thank you so much, Nathan. And
yeah, thank you.
And Paul, I really appreciate you reaching out. And yeah,
you know, that's great. Thanks for making yourself available. Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Well, yeah. Blessings to you too. Maybe.
Good luck
well.
With the lambs.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye. Bye-bye.